All right. Yes. Nice meeting you in this context. I have known you, but we have never spoken before, I think.
Yes. I think we've only exchanged a few words in Bamako.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was pretty much it.
Yes. I'm good. I guess you are not in Accra.
I'm in Accra at the moment. I have been in Tamale, in the north of the country,
mm-hmm.
for a few weeks, but I arrived in Accra 2 days ago, or two nights ago.
Ah, great. And I'm in Berlin, you know, where, you know, based sometimes when I'm not in Nigeria. Yeah, the podcast is called Dots of Thoughts, and it's basically a platform where to conjure a space for the performance and enactment of togetherness, discuss ideas where unmitigated, where you... It's basically thoughts that I have, questions that I have, things that I picked up. It could be anything. But the point is to have a space where we can sort of like flesh things out a bit, go mm-hmm. into some tangents of something that starts with, you know, a dot of thought. So that's the whole idea. And speaking of which, the thought here is your work in this book, Africa State of Mind.
I think I have a copy right here myself.
Ah, yes. The first podcast was with Eko Eshun, who is the curator and, you know, who put together the book. I mean, we were able to sort of like get a sense of what he was thinking. One of which is that the book was really emphasizing on 21st century African image makers and photographers. And so this is something we're also going to touch on as we speak. But for me, what stands out, you know, in some of the works, yours particularly, is how, you know, photographers are using the medium in such a way as to interrogate, not just, you know, to tell their own or to sort of like unleash their own subjectivity into the world, but it's also to interrogate the medium and to ask. It's basically like to decolonize. I don't like using that word a lot, but let's, for the sake of it, decolonize the medium. But most importantly, to free it from itself so that it can do what it wants, that it needs to do for us or for that, for our subjectivity. So let's begin from that perspective and discuss your work that we have here, which is Just Like Us. But before we even get ahead of ourselves, how would you introduce yourself? Please tell us who you are and how you like to call yourself or see yourself.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for asking me to be on this show. I was really thrilled when you wrote. And I think opportunities like this to think aloud are very necessary. And so thank you again for asking me to be on this program with you. My name is Eric Jemfi, and I call myself a photographer. I am a photographer living and working mostly in Accra, Ghana. I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah?
That's it.
It's interesting because when you think photographer, the history of photography in the continent, you know, it goes many ways. People who are dominating that realm of calling themselves photographers and are mainly commercial photographers these days, really. In the reality of the continent.
Right.
One would think that, you know, your kind of photographer or your kind of photography is a given. Actually, in the world you live in Accra, in Ghana, in West Africa, when you call yourself I'm a photographer, a lot of photographers will be like, what are you doing with you? What is that one you're doing?
I get that a lot.
It's interesting. Anyway, so let's get into that work, Just Like Us. Can you sort of like give it a sense of what the work is about?
So this is a project I had been thinking about sometime in 2015. I think I graduated from the university in 2014. So in a nutshell, Just Like Us is a documentary project that looks at, or that looked at the time, at what it meant to be queer or to live as a queer person in Ghana. So it follows a very typical documentary strategy or form. So I lived with several friends and people who would become friends in the process through introduction from friends. And then in the course of a year, I would make some images. And at the end of the period, I put them together into a body of work to speak about what it meant to be queer in Ghana at the time. That's the work in a nutshell.
That was very interesting, actually. The whole reality of queer in West Africa is one that is fraught with a lot of controversies, you know, and that's to put it lightly. In Nigeria, if you are queer and it becomes explicit, you go to jail for it, for that 14 years. And there is also what is called an accomplice. I don't know what that means, really. That is to say, you are not queer, but you're an accomplice to that. Like, man, so you get 7 years.
You accommodate.
Yeah, you accommodate. Yeah.
That
you,
is bizarre.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So for someone like you now who's photographed them, you are an accomplice to, you accommodate that. So you have 7 years already if you step into Nigeria. You know,
plus 14 years because I happen to be queer myself.
Oh, you see, that's, can you imagine that? I mean, one will say yes, because you are queer. So it comes as a given or natural to you to want to address that. But that is also not how you approached it. You said to, no, I do not want to make an emphasis on the fact that I'm queer. That is not the point. I am using my photography to sort of like normalize and to say, this is something that, I mean, we are very much a part of the society and it shouldn't be singled out on the corner. The premise of looking at this work shouldn't be, oh, I am queer and therefore I have to make this, because again, it puts it in that category of something that is special, unique, and uncanny. I mean, that's the first approach. And I think it defined the work and even your way of entering the images. That's what I think. So can you give a sense of how you are structuring your thoughts as you are thinking of taking on this as a project?
Right. So I started this project as a very young photographer. And I think when one takes into consideration how long I had been practicing for and how I conceptualized or entered this project, there a lot of nuances develop that I think cannot be taken for granted. So naturally, as a photographer on the continent, and if I'm wrong, you could correct me, I think when you start out practicing as self-taught, the first place you look to is the internet. And so Google and photographers whose works are out there, photographers who are famous, works that have made the rounds on Magnum, on Vue, on Seven, on, you know, Noah, and all of these platforms. These are the photographers you look up to. And then you try to emulate, depending on which of these languages you feel connected to. And so with time, you hone and you thin down. And if you are lucky, you develop a language of your own. If you're not, you continue mimicking other photographers. So this is the context I was coming from at the time. When I decided to embark on this project, I think I had only done one proper documentary body of work to my name. And so I looked at what had been done pertaining to queerness in Ghana, but also within the region. And one of the obvious images that spoke to this was Anele Moholy's Faces and Phases, which I think is one of the most brilliant documentary bodies of work pertaining to this. And I have been lucky to see the work in person and to see just formally how the portraits are structured and how the representations inside of them change over time. And when I say representation, I mean the people who are photographed, how they change over time. So this was very interesting to me. I think I also saw some work by Lyle Ashton Harris, who had also done a project in Accra, also pertaining or around queerness. But immediately I knew that I wanted to understand more about what it meant to be queer, because I myself did not have a complete understanding, like the kind of images to expect, how lives were lived. I wasn't entirely sure, because I hadn't seen the day-to-day lives of queer persons photographed in a strictly documentary sense here. And so immediately I knew this was an approach I wanted to take. And being young and broke and unemployed became like an advantage to me, because it meant that I didn't have to live in one place, that I could continuously move for almost a year. And so I would ask friends, oh, can I stay with you? I'm doing this project about queerness, queer life. Can I make photographs? You know, I'm not looking to doing anything spectacular, blah, blah, blah. And so this is how the work developed over time. I think I chose to emphasize on the mundane or on the everyday, because I knew that within that very specific ways of living would show up. I mean, I think it takes a lot more work to pick those things up. But when a work is so mundane and so everyday, the nuances of that space, the nuances of the people being photographed, and the nuances of of photography in general start to crop up. And even then, I knew this was something I was interested in.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually, that you are having sort of like this fine thinking already. And because, again, you said that you were actually coming out of school and like young and dabbling, and you are already having this very fine way of thinking, of seeing, you know, much of what photography has done. Of course, what that implies is that much of how it's been curated, you know, worked on, photoshopped, all of that. And there's all this acrobatics of photography. You know, you have to, composition is everything here and there, all these things that they tell you. You know, you have to see things looking really like, oh, wow. But then you're thinking, but this is not telling me anything about even my own reality, because I know how much it could be in obscurity. So much that even people who live it don't know what it's like to be in that society. You know, when I was in secondary school back in Nigeria, we had a whole space, you know, for queer. You know, it was there. It was a boys' school. You know, your parents would take you to boys' school simply because they don't want you to impregnate a woman. So they don't put you in a mixed school. So they say, you know, go to a boys' school. That's, yeah, you know, it's interesting. But then in a boys' school, that intimacy is there. But it's so obscure and it's so dodgy and hidden that, you know, you are, if you ever find yourself in that line, you know yourself within you that you've crossed the threshold of something almost abominable. I tell you, abominable, you know. Yeah. But yes. But it's always there in the everyday. But you just don't know. Mm. You know, it's almost as if you could easily just get into it, and then you find yourself dealing with a situation that everyone around you will tell you it's. You see boys called up to the assembly, because it was a dormitory school. It was a seminary school. You see boys called up to the assembly, wow, and then expel them. But you know what's interesting? No one says why they've been expelled. Expel. Oh, wow. I'm not saying suspended. I'm not saying suspended. I'm saying expel. Like, you're done with this school. And no one says why. Again, you'll be like, okay, no one does that stuff. That stuff. So as you say this now, like, you're looking to see through photography to even understand, you know, how to be, what it means for you. I find that very, very interesting. And that you also began to think the mundane is where you just have to allow it to come out. You know, it's almost like it has to, you need to allow it to come to the camera as opposed to the camera getting into it. I find that very interesting.
Right.
I find that very interesting. And we see it also in the images, the intimacy, the uncanny moments without necessarily emphasizing on uncanniness. It's basically the kind of uncanniness that carries within it revelation as opposed to appearance, you know. And this is what I find very interesting about the body of work.
Well, you've mentioned a few things. I have also been in boarding school since I was in primary. And I think the only time I experienced like a visible rift between, or like a separation between, oh, these boys are queer versus these people are not and queer is bad, was when I went to senior secondary school. Mm-hmm. In junior secondary school, everything was so, and I was in boarding school then, everything was so, I didn't even know what gay was. I had never heard of it. Mm-hmm. I heard it in my final year, and it was strange. It was like, okay, it was one of my seniors saying, oh, you know, abroad, men that sleep with men are called gay. And I was completely clueless. I had no idea what that was, but I understood it. So when I started this project, something that kept like knocking in the back of my head was in how labels themselves carry a lot of baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And so immediately we switched from not being called anything necessarily or specifically to being called gay.
Mm-hmm.
A big shift happened because now all of our experiences was directly connected to Euro-American experiences, mm-hmm. of what queerness is and how it's lived, which I agree has lots of intersections, but they are not necessarily the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps to go back to some of the strategies I used in photographing, there was also a sense of wanting to understand what these specific contexts. And when I say specific context, I mean the context within Ghana where I was photographing were. And believe me, even I as a queer person had internalized so much of the, I don't want to say homophobia, but perhaps the misconceptions about how queer lives are lived, that when I met the first queer couple, mm-hmm. my age, who are living together, who had lived together for many years, I was shocked. I was completely shocked. I thought, is this real? Mm-hmm. Are these people for real? And then I kept meeting different configurations of relationships, different ways of living that I had not been exposed to. And I'm talking a university graduate. I had graduated from the university. I must have been at least 24 or 23.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no clue,
mm-hmm.
no clue how queer persons actually live, you know, like from being a teenager to being an adult. I was clueless. I met a queer man who was 72 and had a pub somewhere in the city. And I was completely shocked that there was an older man who was queer. It's just all of these things that we easily take for granted. You know, like there's very few templates as to how queer life is lived. And in a world lived primarily through the screen, primarily through images, it's ridiculous to imagine that representation in this way is so inadequate or is almost non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think these contexts makes even me understand what it is I was looking for at the time, even if they weren't entirely apparent to me,
mm-hmm.
or even if I didn't know them crisply, I still had a sense of direction. I still had a sense of what it is that could form a part of a good archive.
Mm-hmm.
of queerness.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, now a lot has changed. If I'm to approach the project, there's things that I would change, you know, like with memes and with Instagram and with all of these performances, mm-hmm. going on, things have decentralized a bit more.
Yeah.
But in 2015, which was just 2 days ago, it was it was a bit more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll go to the book now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's very interesting, actually, these things that you're saying. I think this is basically why, or rather the space that this work fits in a timely way and the approach to it. I mean, before we move on, let's look at some of the images. I'm thinking of the one of the two ladies who are sort of like looking at each other and saying something to each other. You know, what I've always found very interesting about this, but also the photograph above that one, which is Kwasi in bed, and he's looking at his, you know, half-folded fist, you know, and mm-hmm. perhaps wondering or thinking of something. There are these moments where you sort of like enter a moment of intimacy, but in a very unobtrusive way, in a way of saying, I'm a witness. And this kind of witness, of course, I'm referring to the witness, the way that someone like James Baldwin used the notion of being a witness, not an observer. It is a witness mm-hmm. who knows that my look in here is a very proactive one, yet it doesn't interfere, but is going to come back later to testify.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the role of a witness as opposed to an observer, is that the witness
mm-hmm.
is always mindful and aware of the burden of history, of the responsibility of history, and that one day he or she will testify. And I feel like there is that witnessing that's happening always, because it's almost as if everyone in the image has just the image, or what is happening within the images were left, you know, to themselves to happen. I don't know how you see this. This is my reading of the images. I don't know what you think about this.
I think having lived with Well, first of all, Kwesi, I lived with Kwesi was actually one of the first people I made photographs of because he's my closest friend. And Amma and Shana, I had also lived with at Neopodice actually for some time. This photograph was made, I think at the time we were training young children in a part of the city called Kaneshi, how to make photographs of themselves. And so we would go to the school, do some exercises with them, and then close. So I think this photograph was made during lunchtime, I think after the training sessions with the kids. With Kwesi's image, we had taken a road trip and we're living together, sharing the same room, three of us. And so this photograph was also made at one point in time. I'm not necessarily sure what was happening, but I probably just saw him laying in bed in this kind of contemplative mood, and I thought it was an interesting photograph.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of the photographs happened in this kind of way, where I would leave my camera and pick it up every now and then when something little was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Or when nothing was happening in some instances, but also allowing for my camera to be used on me. And so there are instances of a few photographs, perhaps not in this book, that I am inside as well, made by some of my friends. And I think these were some of the strategies that made the work, first of all, very easy to make, mm-hmm. because I didn't expect a work like this to be very easy to make, but the process was quite easy. And a lot of the people in the photograph also don't seem to be doing anything spectacular or having any specific big epic moments, but I read all the epicness into some of these actions, some of these seemingly soft and quiet moments.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's there. The epicness is there. And with time, it settles. You know, it's like dust. You know, it settles and settles. And as we go further in, as we continue to interrogate what photography and how photography operates within the realities of people in the African continent, I say this specifically because I think it's a continent that's been, you know, heavily photographed. At the same time, photography has done so much injustice. It has hidden so much of that reality, so much that you realize that it is moments like this, uncanny moments, when people don't expect a camera to be turned on. These are actually where the images are all hidden, you know, at those moments where, because everything about how projects are approached in the continent, it has to have a theme, a title, a this, a that, you know, a name to it. Like you've said already, when you name something, you're always naming it in relation to something that is brought in from elsewhere. You know, but then when you say, how about we just go with that flow of, don't name it, just be it, just enter it. Fast forward to 2019, you did the you won this award of the Paul Huff Award at the forum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
yes,
again, some of the media around that project or the award describe your work as, or your approach as that Trojan horse approach to the medium. That is, that's what they said. Almost infiltrating the medium. So can you talk about that project and why, you know, in the West they had to keep talking about Trojan horse? So like,
Charlie, this Trojan horse, I don't even know what the Trojan horse is. I don't really know. I guess it's something that obscures another thing from the movie.
yeah. So, when you think about that now, why is your work seen as a Trojan horse to something in relation to what?
I think maybe the way that I would read it would be completely different from the way that the jury, how the jury used it. So I would just stick with my interpretation of it. Yeah. I think if I look at my practice over the years and currently, perhaps the Trojan horse comes in the form of presenting photography, but using photography to undo itself in a way. maybe that's where the Trojan horseness comes in, because I'm very interested in the medium. I'm interested in it structurally. I'm interested in how it comes together, like what becomes photography. And how else we could think or reconfigure our understanding of it. Mm-hmm. And so I have been heavily interested in the beginnings of it. And when I say the beginnings, it's I'm limiting it to 1839 France, Daguerre, attempting to find links and possibilities going way beyond the camera obscura to think about what other possibilities have come before to make photography what it is. And you find a lot of cues in the past. You find a lot of cues in several continents or different places. And it removes photography from this Euro-American invention and scatters it in many places. And I think that when we write about photography or when we think about photography, that a lot of emphasis goes into, you know, like this invention at this date and how it changed and how we have what we have now, blah, blah, blah. But I think there's so much more that comes into it. When you look at how photographers, early West African photographers have had to deal with the medium, what they've had to add to the medium, you know, like the conditions that they've had to deal with, like the humidities, the lack, perhaps having to wait for chemicals to arrive, perhaps having to invent their own chemicals, perhaps having to work with the humidity and the heavy salt concentrated air that a lot of them would have experienced along the coast, developing their own enlargers that may not necessarily be the same as the kind of enlargers that Western photographers have been using, making holes, you know, like working with the environment sometimes. All of these nuances are lost. When one even thinks of dyeing or stamping or certain aspects of photogramming, like things falling on pigments that are photosensitive in a way, or leaves or leather or something that's photosensitive and making an impression. It's, you know, there's, you can keep going back and back and back and back and back. And I am interested in all of these things and how that comes back to affect the way forward with photography, or what else photography can be or what it can do. This was a long-winded answer to the Trojan horse thing, but I guess I am exploring other disciplines and bringing them into photography and framing them as photography with the intention of expanding what photography is or can be or can do.
Yeah, that is very relatable. You know, the things you're saying and also the analogies that you're making, very relatable. Mm-hmm. You know, it got me thinking even, so what happens to photography even when there is no camera? And again, mm-hmm. if camera was invented in the West, but we know that seeing and articulating what mm-hmm. is seen is not invented by the West. So what happens? Mm-hmm. So again, to mm-hmm. add to that, all the nuances that are lost, I think there is also that, which is how have we been seeing while we were waiting for the camera to arrive? you know, not just the chemicals, but the camera itself, you know? And how are you able to sort of like incorporate that into that project that USB TED? What's the title again?
It was called Fixing Shadows, mm-hmm. Julius and I. And I think that project formed the beginnings of my interest in looking at photography from quote unquote the eyes or the experience of other disciplines. A little bit about Fixing Shadows. Fixing Shadows combines portraits of composer, vocalist, dancer, overall musician Julius Eastman, and a portrait of myself, and so it merges them continuously in different configurations, different shapes, and the images are printed chemically using cyanotype chemistry and exposed outside and left to the elements, and in return I get different variations of this combination of Julius Eastman and myself. Oh, the portraits of which are neither Julius Eastman nor myself, but the two of us. And so this was using photography to make portraits of people who don't exist, which I thought was an interesting thing, an interesting exercise to do, but also just making so many of them. I think that's pretty much the project. We would need a whole other call to be able to speak about it properly.
And now what I find very interesting is your latest project, the one that just happened recently,
schoolwork, actually.
Yeah, your schoolwork, yeah. And, you know, this whole idea of you having doing your master's in, what was the school again?
The Kwame Nkrumah University for Science and Technology. And I'm at the Department of Painting and Sculpture.
Yeah, a lot of great things are happening. It's almost like a powerful, powerful center. A lot is happening there, not just for Accra, for Ghana, for West Africa, for Africa, but for our time, you know. There's a lot happening in that school, which I'm hoping that many schools in other parts of the African continent will sort of like, you know, follow the kind of seriousness that is happening there. So that project sort of like zeroes in. I was looking at the exhibition, but also where you exhibited and what it is all about, you know. And now you're looking at nature, plants, and using photography to interrogate, you know, many things within that. Can you talk about that a little bit or a lot if you want?
All right. So I feel really lucky to be in an institution where my lecturers are incredibly supportive of very divergent approaches to doing what we do. Mm-hmm. I have received immense support just going so outside of photography in order to come back to it. And I think without this kind of support or structure, I would perhaps not be able to work and think in the way that I'm doing now. So that's something I'm really appreciative of. That's something that this is the general spirit of the department. And I think it's what enables artists coming out of it to be able to do the things that they do in the ways that they do them. So this project started off when I started thinking about certain photographic experiments that were ended for whatever reasons. And so I looked particularly to the antotype process, which was allegedly developed by Juan Mary Somerville and Sir John Herschel. Sir John Herschel. Mm-hmm. Who have both made very considerable impacts on photography.
Yeah.
And so I think at a certain point, there was a quest for developing color photographs or the potential for developing color photographs. And I think this would be sometime in the 1840s. And so scientists turned to plants and plant pigments in an attempt to perhaps layer to develop some kind of color photograph. But I think the thing with the weather conditions that existed in the place where lots of these experiments were being conducted was they had a predominantly cold weather, which meant that the amount of UV that would come from the sun, which mostly enables some of these prints to happen, was very low. But also even recently finding out that lots of tropical plants are relatively more photosensitive than their extreme northern hemisphere counterparts. This made me interested in looking at what plants existed around me in my neighborhood and how they could give photographs. So for those who may not know, antotypes are really simple. You pick plant parts like the leaves or the petals, any part that you think might be photosensitive, and you crush it with alcohol or water. You extract a pigment, you rub it on paper, and you put a positive, because it is a positive process. And so you put a transparency or a paper negative, a paper positive on it, and then you contact print, put it in the sun. And so the sun bleaches out the parts that are transparent or translucent, and then the parts that are not are left. And so you have an image. So it's really simple. So when you actually think about this process, you think, oh, our grandfathers might have been doing something similar, maybe not calling it antotype necessarily, but, you know, like even when you die, you know, like, and you want to make patterns or stuff, there are instances where you could block. So you could block out certain parts and then allow certain parts to react with a chemical or mm-hmm. to react with the sun or react to, you know, it's it's not something that's overly complicated, which is why I think if we had some of these experiments, we could perhaps trace photography back. Maybe it wouldn't be called photography, but
yeah.
So I start from some of these experiments, and instead of just bringing them back as, oh, autotype was being done, blah, 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 I pretend like the experiments weren't stopped. So I resume them, and then I add my own processes. I build on them. I change the support. I change the material. I bring in so many other things, and then I develop something different from it. But beyond attempting to represent something, I think I have been more interested in what frames a photograph, what a photograph is composed of, how images are organized, or like how a photograph is organized, how we put the various things inside of the frame and what that frame is. Mm-hmm. I attempt to put that out in space or in a place. So to organize a place, for instance, almost like it was a photograph, or to organize things within a certain institution, almost like it was a photograph.
That's interesting. And also the title is really apt, you know, the things that are left hanging in the air, like a rumor. That's the title. And I feel like it sort of like gives it the frame that allows it to be a continuous probing, you know, something left hanging in the air, like a rumor. It's left hanging in the air, but it's not, you know, in as much as it's been negated, you know, not referenced, because now we've made other things the center. It doesn't mean that it became, that it disappeared, you know, but it's still there in the air, which means if you reach out, you can still begin to put it together and collate it. Now, it's interesting because we talk about knowledge, but we forget that there's also who sort of like gathers this knowledge together, you know, who brings them together.
Right.
Because things are constantly moving. Everything has this kinetic energy. So again, you realize that when you are displacing, moving, arranging, I mean, we're talking about becoming and being. You know, this whole notion of being, you know, so we want to be, we want to become. But again, that process in and of itself is a kinetic process. That is, you know, you can arrange a different kind of being and a different kind of way of being by just bringing things together, things that are already there, things that are already hanging in the air like a rumor.
Right.
Oftentimes we see a photographer as someone who goes and makes a photo, or who makes it sort of like a mise-en-scene. But we do not see a photographer as someone who will say, let me go and look at that plant and see, you know, what it can do. And that I find very interesting. I also saw the way you presented it, but also the place you exhibited. Can you talk about the relationship between the work and the presentation, but also the location?
Right. So before I go to that, you say something very interesting about arranging, configuring, and this is very much at the heart of photography, not of all photography, but of most photography. There is always an arrangement going on, whether it happens in a split second, as in a lot of cases, or whether it happens over 6 months or a year, as in my case. It's still a process of organizing. But I'm interested in what frames that arrangement, that configuration, which when we experience a photograph is missing. We usually do not know, especially within social documentary practice, all of the frames are missing. So the institutional frame, the commissioning frame, the frame, the subjective frame of the photographer, so many frames that are not available for the audience or people who engage with these photographs to deal with. And so I am very much interested in that frame. It's why I attempt to, instead of organizing my photograph within such a frame, I throw it out into an institution like the Center for Plant Medicine Research, where I am holding, or my current exhibition is still ongoing. I went to the Center for Plant Medicine Research at a point when I felt like I had exhausted the possibilities of what I could do with my experiments and needed expert insight into plant chemistry, but also into the weather. And so I decided to intern at the Center for Plant Medicine Research. And some of the things that I did at the center for many, many months was actually documenting. And so I am speaking about reorganizing, but I have had to use the same frames that I am almost critiquing here to be able to do the things that I am doing, to be able to take myself out of the frame I have had to use the frame. And so I started off documenting all of the plant specimens that the institution had on their various farms across the country. In going about the project in this roundabout way, I learned so much about the kinds of plants they had, but the histories of these plants also, the relevance of its usage for humans, but for other plants and other living organisms. I learned a lot about these. And then I came back to document all of their herbarium specimens that had been pressed, thousands of them since 1972. And it was within this process that I learned about a certain plant called Cryptolepis. Locally, it's called Nibima. And going through several plants, I realized that this plant was very peculiar to the institution because it was the first plant that, it was one of the first plants on which extensive research was done by the institution. The plant has a very rich yellow pigment from the roots that has a long history of dyeing, especially with goat leather or dyeing goat leather, which I thought would have some link to photography or at least to photogramming in a way. And then in recent times, the plant has been so potent against COVID that the Food and Drugs Board has approved for it to undergo a series of tests and to be potentially ruled out as a remnant of COVID. And so I'm working with several interests within this plant that I think is relevant both to photography and to some of the things that I'm trying to do. And so I start off from this plant, looking at the plant, working with it, growing some of them, making notes about how it relates to photography, but also how it relates to the institution. After a period of work, I decided to stage my exhibition, my thesis exhibition, in the waiting area of the institution, which doubles as a clinic. The waiting area is interesting for all of these things, but it's also just how time functions in the waiting area when people just have to sit and wait and not speak, and not speak above a certain pitch or note. There's a level of concentration that is at the waiting area that I thought I could interrupt because the only imminent event is a trip to the doctor's office or into the consulting booths. And I thought it would be very interesting to intervene in that waiting, so almost situate myself between the anticipation of the doctor's office and, you know, like the entire act of sitting, like put myself right in the middle. And so it's why I thought the waiting area was interesting. So there's a thinking around time here, but also relates very much with photography and how photography uses time or how photography plays on time.
That's amazing. You know, this whole idea of space, deliberating on, you know, where to show the work. It's not just the work only, but also where to show it is also something that I feel there's a need to explore some more. There will be a lot of exploration of that. Because we often talk about work in public space, audience, da-da-da. But again, it's not just public space, put something on the street. It's also all those spaces that are also intimate spaces, but even though they are public, and but also that functions in a particular way. Like you just really said it now perfectly. There is that space of transition between, you know, that moment of pause, you know, between going to the doctor. And who are the people going to the doctors? The everyday person, you know, but they are waiting, anticipating something. And it's an interesting space to just sort of like intervene in. There is intimacy there. There is that conversation happening just by virtue of where you bring the work to. But again, it's not completely out of context. It's not like, okay, I chose the waiting area. You also did your internship there, right? And then, and so it's very much a part of the work itself and your process as well.
Right. It's also so interesting how simple things like light even changed within the waiting area. So the waiting area is at the same time undergoing renovation. And so it's a long haul. And you have a right side and you have a left side. And so when I installed the work, the left side was completely blank. So you had like a big gush of light pouring into the entire space. And within a space of a month and a half, the left side has been almost completely closed. And so even the way in which light is functioning in the space, the way in which light is affecting the work, it's all changing. And so there's still something very photographic about about the entire process. That
you also intervened on the windows and on the window panes as well.
I chemically treated all of them with a part of the plant, and so I think it's perhaps one of the interesting parts of the work for me in the fact that you don't even have to look at the window. At certain times of the day, as you sit, light passes through the windows, which I consider photographs, and it falls on you. Mm-hmm. And so also perhaps even thinking about how blind people or visually impaired people could experience photographs, for instance, this creates a possibility, it creates a possibility that you could experience a photograph as light, or you could even experience it as a drink, or that other beings outside of humans, like enzymes and microbes or whatever, also have the potential in some funny way to experience some of the photographs that I'm creating. And I think all of these little things are interesting to me. But we have been speaking a lot, and I'm also keen to hear your thoughts on photography on the continent today, and what you think is the way forward. Like, what else can photography do, or where do we go from here with where the world is now, with COVID, with working from home, with all of the restructuring that's going on, with phones, with, there's just so much that has been introduced in the past 5 to 10 years, or perhaps in the past 15 to 20, since you've been practicing. Could you speak to where we could go from here relating to photography, but also feel free to go outside of it?
Well, for me, I think that it's, when we're talking about going outside of it, the way I see things, everything, and photography included, art, music, which is one of the reasons why I do not limit myself anymore what I want to do, is first and foremost that we are articulating our time, that we are taking part in the conversation of our time, and that this medium that we are using are basically things that they're like tools at our disposal. Much of them been taught how to use it and the only way to use it. But you realize that the knowledge, like we've been discussing here, you realize that the knowledge is when you now take that tool and then begin to apply it elsewhere. When you think of it from that angle, you realize that there's just so much at our disposal that we can work with. But what we need to do now is to take it to somewhere, transpose the mindset and take it elsewhere. For instance, we're talking about photography now, but what about music? Somebody has written a book called The Subversive History of Music by this, historian. He's American. But in that book, I'm sure by the time I get to the end of it, there's very little instances where he talked about the place of the flute, which is a very Igbo thing. Any Igbo sound that you hear the flute. I have not read anything, not seen, not interviewed, not done anything that even tries to understand why the flute and what it does in every music, in every Igbo sound, all the way back. Why is that flute there? Our double bass, contrabass, is a huge calabash, that has a hole. And then you use a foam, you hit it, and it makes that boom sound. And it's also very present. That's the bass, that's the foundation. And then you hear it, and you don't have to hit it so hard. And then the sound comes. What does it do? Why has it been there? So I think that on one hand, we should really participate in all the new technologies coming, understand it properly, in all the technicalities of it and everything. But in the thinking, in where the knowledge, in what it needs to do, we have to sort of like go elsewhere. We have to, because the truth is this, there is no one else. The problem has always been that there is no space enough for the valorization of this knowledge. Because the truth is, you call yourself a photographer, but if you're not careful, you're going to be hungry. If you're not having exhibitions in Europe or in the West, or if you're not getting them to understand your conversation, you're done for, because there's no space. Before you know it, you also begin to ask yourself, all these thoughts that I have, how can I make it in such a way that it enters the Western perspective of the universal? But again, what that really means is a universal that is just one thing that is well-defined, for which everything else that enter is looking to find its own completedness in it. When you are coming into it, it's already assumed that you're not complete. That's why there was that Trojan horse thing. Come on. It has to be a Trojan horse, not an investigation, not that somebody is doing completely something different or taking knowledge elsewhere. It has to be Trojan horse in relation to what? It's in relation to something that's already been defined well and okay, and this person is a disruptor. So, no, It's not that. The person is having a conversation. The person is animating, you know, all these rumors, you know, of things hanging in the air, you know, like a rumor. The person is now going elsewhere. The person is not trying to be a subverter. The person is not trying to be in that sense. And again, I feel like by the time we begin to move away from this whole notion of we have to subvert in relation to what, you know, we have to just begin to look deeper and deeper. All those negated knowledges, all those things that are, you know, hanging in the air, we have to bring all of this technology to it. And of course, it's a gradual process. That for me is also important because we are doing a podcast today. Tomorrow, a younger photographer after you will listen to this podcast, take an excerpt from it, and do something with it. So again, there is all that breaking it. So, but again, it's important that we continue to put out all these materials in different forms. Others will come and take excerpt from it and make something out of it. If there was no well-articulated, you know, research center, you wouldn't have, you know, had access to all of the work you're doing now. Whatever it is that we're doing, however small, we have to understand that we're not doing it for now, that we are also doing it like we are sort of like, you know, it's like that witness thing that I just talked about, that a witness is very proactive. Just, you know, because you know that you have the burden of history and one day you will testify. But what that really means is that you are mindful that the work you're doing is like layer by layer. And we cannot afford to go with this Messiah complex anymore. You know, you know, we cannot.
Right.
We just have to do it little by little. We just have to be consistent and focused on the very little aspects of the questions we are asking. Because if we do it right, someone else coming behind will find value. And most importantly, we want to match that seriousness. Let's put it that way. You know, it's not about skill. It's about when someone says, what? You know, there's a Neo-Buddha in the way he did his work, however little, however in his own way, but you cannot discount his seriousness. You want to match that seriousness in whatever it is that you come with eventually. A lot is happening in our time that is inspiring. First of all, we have to sort of like not give too much credit to mainstream. There are some people who need to be, you know, holding the ground, you know, for us in the mainstream. That's fine. But, you know, there are other places as well. And when I think of it that way, it's like it's all open. Music, photography. Photography can become music. Look at how you're thinking about photography, that even the sun coming in from the window is a photograph. Of course, we know what you're saying there. We know that you're not talking about the one hanging on the wall. You are talking about all the things that could make an image, that could make a scene, that could contribute to a revelation. Revelation was, first of all, a visual category before it became a religious one. Before we begin to talk about the camera, how can we perceive? There is no way we can ask that question without sort of like addressing all these things hanging in the air, like rumor, without collating all of them.
Right.
The African artist is always in that double, triple, quadruple bind of having to, you know, do your work, allow space for your own thinking to just, you know, your own imagination to just run. But also at the same time, once you've traveled to Europe or this, some people are expecting, your family members are expecting you to have some to money, this, to pay for this. The place you're going to get that money is the same people we are very careful of not to sell out to. So you find yourself in the middle. you know, and this is something again that I'm saying, all of us artists, we have to give each other credit for this one simple fact that whoever is doing what, whether it's the person you think is selling out or the person who is not, we are all in that bind. And everybody's looking, first of all, to get out of it before they even begin to think. So when you find people thinking, that's already a lot. If we had institutions, you know, funding institutions within the country that will now back up the school properly and say, look, if we make research centers, you know, and you don't put it only in Accra, you spread it out in the country so that people can be doing things from different places, then we have the support to just reflect and think and just let, you know, and just dig in. And it's, you know, when we say it like this, it feels like it's simple. And it should be that simple. You know, when you have people who are thinkers, don't let them go take off to Canada and live there. They're already in the country. Just create a space for them to continue doing that thinking. But again, many of the artists don't have that opportunity. And I think this is more than anything the biggest challenge. It's not the direction of the thinking, because it's not just Africans that are forcing that. Our time is making it such that we are now moving away from that hegemony, because we've seen is a system that is looking to just preserve itself the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot conflate that with progress, that everything mm-hmm. is all nice and clean and every child born into that system is raised to preserve that. You can't conflate that with progress. Progress is happening elsewhere. Progress is happening in the continent. Progress is happening in Asia. Progress is happening in so many places. And it's something of our time. It's not so.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Just speaking about creating spaces, I think it's also important, because I am just returning from Tamale,
mm-hmm.
from the Red Clay Studio, where I have been doing some work for the space. I think it's very important to highlight some of the work that Ibrahim Mahama.
Yeah.
And all of the communities that are supporting the work in Tamale is doing. It's really important creating institutions that we do not have, that are not funded in any way by the government. I think it's beyond what we could expect in our time. And I feel really lucky to be alive, to witness in the way that you use witness it in this way. All of the work that he's doing, really, really important work. Very necessary work. So just to say that, just to chip that in. And I think it's inspiring for all of us to be able to also contribute in our smallest ways, yeah. Both visually, but also collectively.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but think about ultrasound when you spoke about like being a DJ and making music, but also thinking about photography. It's just like how all of these things are connected, you know, like that images could even be made just by sound waves.
Yeah.
So they always tend to be closer than we imagine, which is why I'm always in favor of interdisciplinary collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to use the opportunity to give a shout out to Neil Budai, because a lot of the things that I've learned in my practice as a result of being in his house and working in his studios and just watching him make photographs or develop them later in the dark room, my interest in looking at photographic chemistry is heavily influenced from my time and experience there. And these are moments that I cherish so much. So just to put this out there as well, there are a few photographers around who are also actively interested in educating younger photographers in this way, or sharing or imparting what they have learned over the years. And we are super grateful for these persons, you know, like within the ecosystem of photography in the country, but also on the continent. All of the photographers I've learned from over the years, Akimbode, Akimbi, Ankobode, all of the photographers, some of whom I have not met, you know, like some online, Ucheopa, you know, like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So many, Santu Mohoken, Andrew Shubango, Zenaida Moholi, James Bano, so many photographers, and my contemporaries, Francisco Croco, Rahima Gambo, from everywhere, just so many photographers. It's hard to keep up with names, but all of these people know themselves. And like you said, it's really hard to experiment, or to say you're going to experiment, but also to survive. And, you know, like when you hit your 30s, support a partner or support kids or support family. It's not easy decisions, you know. And it takes a lot to be able to still say that I'm going to go on this road. I'm going to, you know, be on this path, like with very little support, without necessarily making Europe and America my center. It takes a lot. And so I commend all of the photographers who are keeping the fort and pushing and inspiring us and continuously breaking the bounds. Is it bound? What do they say? Breaking the... Yeah, whatever they say, breaking the boundary or whatever.
Yeah.
All of these, you know.
Yeah, the people you've mentioned now, it's a whole, these are, you know, it's the history, you know, it's the history of our 50 years into now. All the names you've mentioned will be the ones who have made our history. Mm-hmm. If ever we are going to sort of like point it towards an understanding of our own reality, of our own way of being in the world, it is what you know, people who are coming after you now, there's going to be artists after you as well. The way you are working now, I remember my very first project when I was just 22 years old, 2002. It was a photography workshop. And they say, do a project and bring it, a photography project. I decided to do some. I said, let me look into the afterlife. But what did I do? I went to my uncle, who was a pathologist. He was like the senior doctor working at the morgue, basically. And I went there and I said to him, I'm interested in this whole idea of afterlife. Can I sort of like photograph the morgue? He looked at me. It's like, nobody ever brings a camera here. It doesn't happen. See, that's 2002, 2 years into the 21st century. There is a place we're not allowed to take the camera into. But he was my uncle, so he gave me access. Photograph as you want. Already at that age, I could watch him. I was photographing him dissecting bodies, right? And teaching other doctors.
Wow.
Right there. When I brought the photographs to the class, everybody just went quiet. That was my first lesson about what photography can do. It's not so much about what you photograph as opposed to where you take yourself to. The courage. Mm. There are so many places the camera needs to enter. And even if you should go by the way you are using the medium now, there are so many places we have to even enter before we begin to talk about the camera, you know. And so I think that, of course, what was it? You would think, oh, well, photographing. I realized that there's no image I made in that morgue that wasn't going to be a great image, simply because I was there already. I was there. I made the photograph by just bringing myself there in the first place, by having access in there. If I decided to photograph this, the light bulb, the name at the door, the toe of the feet of the person, that anything I photograph, anywhere I decide to photograph, if I want to lie down, whatever it is I want to do in that space, the space was already the photography. It wasn't me making photos. Again, that's why I relate to what you are trying to do here, saying, look, it's not this whole space, this whole exhibition in this waiting room is the photograph, not what I'm photographing. This is a photograph.
Right.
All the reactions, all the things that will happen, you know, in all this fragmentary way, the lights coming in, the one that is, that's the photograph, you know. So I can relate to that. And I think that more and more of this should happen, where we bring back the social function of photography, where it interacts. You know, this is why I appreciate what is happening in Tamale with, you know, Ibrahim Mahama's space, because it is not looking to be this static thing where everybody comes to look at things on the wall. It is a place where you're questioning, where you're interacting. It's always, art has always been that for us. You know, it's never been a vitrine, put things in a glass per se. It's always been that the people who are interacting with what you're making is what makes it art. So that both the interaction, both the object that people are interacting with, everything becomes that thing.
Right.
When somebody walks into that waiting room and sits, that's a photograph. When somebody walks out of it, when somebody touches the table and almost about to pass and say, wait, what am I touching? Turns back and looks at it. That's a photograph. Right. You know, so
You just summarized it in the most clear, beautiful, elegant way, and I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a function of everything else. Everything comes together to form it.
Yeah, yeah.
And without everything coming together in that way, there's nothing.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
So keep that.
All right, this has been a wonderful conversation, Eric.
You're really nice.
Really
nice speaking with you.
Yeah. All right. So, well, keep up the good work. That's all I can say.
Thank you. It's a joy to be alive today.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.